Blog Talk Radio.
Nalindilele pakumfwa kamangu kababemba kalila.
Through this song, I remember and celebrate the life of Zambia's unsung heroes. I remember Robinson Puta, Titus Mukupo, Lawrence Katilungu, Michael Chilishe, Patu Simoko, Timi Mvula, Teddy Chilambe, Spock Chola, Brian Chiwangu, Godfrey Chitalu, Alex Chola, and the unnamed mothers, daughters, and sisters that have inspired us all for the greater good of this country. So hear me out.
Welcome to Zambia Blog Talk Radio. This is Nathan Nkama from Dallas, Texas. We do thank you for joining us on this first Saturday of the fifth month of the year, May. And it's amazing how time is flying. We do appreciate everybody for joining us from wherever you are calling us. And we always value your time. It's actually 8:02 in Central Standard Time, 15:02 in Zambia, and it is 1:02 in GMT time in the British places and all those areas, 9 p.m. in Australia, western part of Australia, and we do appreciate everybody joining us. This morning, just like a few words of the opening song says, Zambia's unsung heroes. We always have a tendency, Dr. Patrick, to look far and beyond when you're trying to get people or guests to be on this show. And you can ignore your very unsung heroes who are with you every day. Just because they are with you every day, you tend to develop a tendency of familiarity. So this morning I thought that we should talk to one of our, colleagues, in a way, is a regular contributor to this show. When I promoted the show, I wrote on social media, I said, distinguished scholar, which I believe he is. You don't need to believe that, but he is. He has proved himself. He has the credentials. And we'll be talking to our very own Dr. Gilbert Kalonde. But before I go, Dr. Kalonde, let me say good morning, Pianki.
Good morning, Nathan. How are you, sir? And I concur with your recognition of your local heroes.
Yes.
And given the proper time, I hope that you can talk more about them, because I would be interested in learning about the feats that they have performed throughout history.
Yeah, it's true. It's very true. I agree with you, Pianki, and it's very important that we do this. All right, one of our other unsung heroes, too, joining us from the desert country of the Emirates, Dr. Kasonso, good evening. You are breaking up. I don't know what you need to do, because there's something I want you to say, and we need to hear you clearly. Are you good? All right. Happy blessed birthday, my brother.
Thank you so much.
Okay, excellent. You need to adjust your mic or your connection, because we can barely hear you. Dr. Patrick, how are the Carolinas?
One
wonderful, wonderful, my brother. And let me add to Pianki, your unsung heroes is also our unsung heroes. And I look forward to hearing more and reading more about our brothers and sisters.
Excellent, excellent. All right, I think not to waste more time. This is my show is not like an open forum where I have to go through the list and talk to everybody. I would like to conserve as much time as possible to speak to our colleague, who is also our guest this morning, Dr. Gilbert Kalonde. I'll just say one or two things about his biography, because if I read the whole thing, it would take half the show. He's a technology and curriculum education assistant professor at Montana State University, and he also serves on the board of the American Civil Liberties Union and the Montana branch. Dr. Kalonde, good morning, and thank you for agreeing that you and I do this. I'm calling it a conversation with Dr. Gilbert Kalonde.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for having me.
Excellent, excellent. Dr. Kalonde, for those who may not know, you've been a teacher all your life, and you are still a teacher at a different level, okay? We shall talk about that later. And when, how did this start? How did this start, you being a teacher?
I'll have to go into some few things before I discuss how I became a teacher. People have to know who Kalonde is. I was born in a family of 12 siblings, from one mother, one father. I was born in Kitwe. I was raised in Kitwe. I went to Mitanto Primary School in Kwacha. And I went to Kitwe Boys Secondary School, which by then was one of the most highly respected schools in the district, or maybe in the province. And after graduation, I was thinking of going into the military, more especially the Air Force, but my interest was very much into art. And there was only one way you could do art in Zambia. It's either you went to Mindelo Ecumenical Foundation or you went to Ivanhoe College. And the Ivanhoe College art, you become a teacher. Now, here is what is part of the history. My father was a teacher in the beginning.
Okay.
Let me say before I was even born. As I said, I was born in a family of 12. I'm the sixth. In the family, and somehow what is funny about all this is that my parents had the first seven children were all boys. We were all boys, so they continued trying to look for a girl. That's what they taught us. So my father being a teacher, dawned on me that it was a good job. That's what I was thinking. Yes. So that's what brought me to thinking of being a teacher.
All right. So father influenced you, and you decided to go. What was your last teaching post in Zambia before you left the country?
My last teaching post was at Chifubu Secondary School in Indola. That was in 1994, January and February. But I had taught at Chelenge Secondary School in Lopla Province for a week and some 3 days. I couldn't stay. As I said, born and raised in Kitwe, it was a bit difficult for me to stay in Chelenge. So I forced myself out of that school. And you know, Zambians, we love soccer very, very much.
Yes.
What really changed me to think of leaving Luapula province was a Zambia Congo game. Zambia played against Zaire, and I could not even know who won the game until I reached Mansa. That's when I knew that Zambia had won. And it was painful for me. It was really, really painful.
That's so very interesting.
So I moved to Mukuba Secondary School, taught at Mukuba Secondary School, which was in my district in Kitwe. Then I was transferred to go to Central Province. But the issues that came in between, I'll discuss later why I found myself at secondary school.
Okay. Those that listen to the show, from your contributions, of course, they know that you're a passionate political analyst and commentator. I want us to go back again into history, something that a lot of people here who listen to you all the time may not know, because these are some of the things you've shared with people that are close to you and who know. You were one of the foot soldiers or grassroots mobilizers in the founding of MMD, Movement for Multi-Party Democracy. Share with us some risks that you faced being a civil servant, a teacher, and then you got involved in this new movement. All of us know how tough and uncompromising Dr. Kaunda and the unique party was. So share with us your experience of that period of your life.
As I said, I left out one part of how I found myself at full secondary school. When the multi-party system started, I was one of the first people to join, and I started working with the people in Kitwe, and one of the people in Kitwe that I was working with in terms of mobilizing people in multi-party system, I mean the MMD, was the late B.Y. Mwila. And I was transferred to Central Province by the principal of the school, who had been promoted as some kind of quid pro quo, because his wife, who was principal at Helen Kaunda Secondary School, had agreed to stand against Mr. Kapapa in the northern province in Kasama. So the man was given as inspector of schools in Central Province, and the wife was going to stand in the northern province in Kasama as the MP on unit ticket. Now, this man, what he did was he transferred me in anger to Central Province, that way I can lose my position in MMD. By then, I was Kitwe District Youth Representative, and at the same time, I was Copper Belt Youth Chairman for MMD. Now, once you transfer somebody from the province where they are, I was going to lose my position in MMD when I was transferred.
Okay.
So I was going to suffer loss. But the dangers of being in as a civil servant and at the same time as a teacher were very, very, very imminent, and somehow were pronounced when the Copper Belt Youth Chairman for UNIP, who was at the MCC's office, drove with a government Land Rover, came to my school and came to my class in anger without even passing through the headmaster's office. And come and took me out of the office. But I was laughing at him because I knew that power had switched hands before MMD even won. So other teachers jumped on him and kicked him out of the school. That they are going to call kids from the classes and beat him up. So the dangers were very, very imminent. And at one point, I knew that I was on the list of the 10 most needed people if Kaunda won to be arrested. And that is on the Copper Belt. I know people who are listening, they know Mr. Kangwansuluka was one of them. Mr. Kampamba in Chilabombo was one of them. There was a young man also in Kitwe with me in the youth. Godfrey Mwambazi is late. He was also one of them. So it was quite a big number of young men that were supposed to be picked up. I don't think Mr. Suruka was young, but most of the people that were being, somehow targeted were young men. We knew this because by then the director of intelligence was not working with UNIP, the Copper Belt area, was not working with UNIP, was working on the side of MMD, but it was difficult for UNIP to know how he was working with us.
Okay. I know people are thinking, oh, why am I going that direction? You are an educator, and I'm still going to connect what we've just discussed to, I want us to focus on education, but there's a reason I asked that question, so that our listeners and everybody who has called in, Dr. Kalonde, can understand the level to which you've been involved in your life politically. Back to education, did the MMD, in your opinion, make any significant educational reforms? If so, what were they?
MMD, when it came into power, it had the very, very good people to be to run the Ministry of Education. Mr. Arthur Wiener became the Minister of Education, and the Dr. Kabunda Kayongo was the Deputy Minister. Then Dr. Kabunda Kayongo became the Minister, and Dr. Shuma Ponda became the Deputy Minister to Dr. Kabunda Kayongo. So all those things somehow helped try to put education in a way that the MMD had put it in their manifesto. Now, there are some few things that changed in MMD government. MMD government opened up the introduction of having all these small universities that we are having that are changing the face of education in Zambia. Otherwise, in terms of other things, in terms of, they just changed from regular primary school to introduce basic education, and they fostered it when they came into power very, very much. But unfortunately, you know, it did not make a great impact on the Zambian population, because as you talk about education, you should also talk about the economy and employment.
Yes.
Because just educating people, and it's like you are, you know, processing in a plant, but the goods are not being sold. That's what we started having in Zambia, whereby we're having a lot of grade 7 leaving schools. We had a lot of grade 9 leaving school and grade 12 leaving school, and even people from colleges who are being processed in their system. But at the end of the processing plant, the goods will go sit on the shelves, and they are not being sold. That's the type of economy that we started having when we started losing jobs from the mines, and at the same time, the manufacturing was dying completely. So education, they did good to introduce a lot of colleges, but at the same time, there was an issue of employment.
Yeah, excellent. Dr. Kalonde, you are aware, and even our colleagues here, regular contributors and callers who have called in, I'll let him ask their questions to you. You are aware that there's been this debate that we should eliminate grade 7 exams. And secondly, it was a mistake, okay? It's the argument I'm trying to put across to you. It was a mistake to move the, what do you call it, Form 3 vis-a-vis grade 10 exam from grade 10 to grade 9. I don't know, what is your position on that? Should we eliminate exams, those exams, or it should remain the same? And what would be the impact on the whole education system? And like you have amply said, how will it affect the economy of Zambia as well?
Both systems have and had their own pros and cons.
Yes.
So we cannot awesomely and say that this one is good, this one is bad. The fact is this, the system that we had in terms of grade 7 exams, grade D, form 3 exams, form 5 exams to go to University of Zambia or to go to college, introduced a competitive position for every child in school. I do remember when I was in form 3 at Kito Boys, we had on top of our green board, it was not a blackboard, of our green board, we had written as students, we wrote something and put it on top of the board where we wrote, some will, some won't. And I do remember the person who wrote that, Cyprian Infuembe, one of the young smart boys that we had in our classrooms. He did very good, went to University of Zambia to do mining. Unfortunately, he passed, he's no longer with us. It fostered some kind of competition in class, knowing that you might be those who would, or you might be one of those who won't go through. So we were competing in every subject. Now, can you use the new system of thinking of having no exams at grade 7, having no exams at form 3?
Uh-huh.
It has worked in some countries, but I don't know if it would work in our country and in our economy. It was one way of choosing the best cream of society to go to higher levels. But at the same time, it put down a large group of people put out of school and not given chance to forge ahead in society, which at one point we started becoming an elitist society, whereby only those reach a certain area or certain position were respected and were accepted in society. So I think the competition was good, but the dropping out of masses was also not good. Probably if the government had thought of introducing or building more schools, probably we could have had more positions. But unfortunately, as a newly developing country, far from where we're supposed to be, even now, I think the politicians positioned by that time concentrate on those who were performing better for them to come and help develop the country and give them chance to go to higher levels. But at the same time, I think we had issues with that, and I still have issues. The same issues that I had with the pregnant young girls who got uh-huh. pregnant and they were kicked out of school. Meanwhile, it was like sentencing the whole family to perpetual poverty because of somebody's one mistake of being pregnant. But that person could have been one of the most intelligent students in the classroom. But because of social experiments, she became pregnant and we kicked them out of school. I don't think that was the right position to take at that time, because we lost a lot of chances by not educating a lot of young females by kicking them out because they became pregnant. And moreover, the system also did the same with the boys. If a boy met a girl pregnant, they would be kicked uh-huh. out. So what the families were doing were not reporting such issues on the side of the boy, because the family was thinking, wait a minute, we can't have both the boy and the girl who is supposed to come and raise the child or the family out of school. So it was not a good decision for that reason. I felt like the government was making a mistake.
Excellent. You are listening to Zambia Block Talk Radio. We are speaking with Dr. Gilbert Kolonde. He's a technology and curriculum education assistant professor at Montana State University. He also serves on the board of American Civil Liberties Union in the state of Montana. Dr. Kolonde, you referred to the MMD government having liberalized to some extent
or change the law on higher education or universities or colleges for that matter. In your view, where I know a lot of universities in Zambia have come up right now, now we are coming to the level of a teacher you are now, which in America is referred to as professor. In other parts of the world, they call lecturer. You are a lecturer at Montana State University. And Zambia, as you referred, you said the MMD are the ones who liberalized, if we may use that term, education, higher education system in Zambia. How has that worked out, in your opinion, in terms of quality of higher education in Zambia?
We have heard recently from the Minister of Higher Education, Professor Nkandluo, talking about trying to remove some schools from the list because of their performance. We do have education systems here in America that helps universities to show that they are performing, they are working, and they are really producing students that they promise to produce, high-quality
yes.
students. And I've gone through that with my university. And the process of accreditation is very, very, very vigorous. And it is very difficult, actually. You have to write some few things in the way they're supposed to be written. You're supposed to inform the community. You're supposed to inform the accreditation board exactly what you are doing and how you plan to do it. And you have to follow the results, how you somehow doubt this is what they're going to do. Now, are we doing the same in Zambia? That's where the issue comes in. It's the accreditation that really has affected the Zambian universities. I don't know exactly what formats they are using for accreditation, but for a minister in that same area to say that she's having concerns, that means there is probably a problem, which I don't know exactly, because I haven't looked at their papers. I haven't looked at the students that they are producing. And we haven't seen, I don't know, maybe others have seen, we haven't seen how positive those students have made our economy and what contributions they've done to our society. All those things comes in terms of how we evaluate the university's position. I wouldn't say they are not doing good because I don't have evidence to say that. I wouldn't say they are doing very good because I don't have evidence for them doing that. So on that one, probably I would let the experts in Zambia talk about it, because at the moment I haven't seen any negative or any positive apart from what I heard from the minister.
Okay. You and I, in our private conversations, we did talk about how higher education influences or directly affects the economic economic situation of a nation or a country vis-a-vis even the employment opportunities. Can you address that, being a higher education educator? How are these connected? Before we talk about your technology, things that you teach, the research that you have done.
Higher education really changes how society is somehow looked at. In terms of productivity, like I mentioned, if you look at most of the findings, most of the research, most of the information that we get as society comes from researchers. And most of these researchers, some of them, they are not professors. They are just researchers in the industry. There are some researchers that stationed in universities, but they are just researchers. They are not even professors. They just do research.
Yes.
Now, in a Zambian situation where we are, we don't have that because the government does not put money into research. And as such, that has affected the way the higher education is positioned in the Zambian economy. We produce manpower to go and work. We do not produce researchers to help us solve problems that always face us in our society, in our communities back home in Zambia, because the government does, I don't know if they don't have money for that, or they have money, but they, you know, somehow position that money maybe into healthy, to help people, and the, in the tertiary and in the secondary education and the primary education. But the research part helps grow the economy in another way.
Uh-huh.
If you look at most of what has happened in America through the NSF, National Science Foundation, and a lot of that has come out in economics, in the science, most of those things have been funded by the government. That is National Science Foundation. They put in billions of dollars every year in terms of research. Why? Because that's how you find out what the problem is, and that's how you find out what the solutions are. Now, in our country, in Zambia, all solutions, or let me say most of the solutions, are brought up in parliament by people who don't even have their own manpower to do research to what they are talking about or what they are planning to do. So basically, you go, an MP does not have a team of people who work with them to do research, to find out, to read, and all such things. So things are done or solutions are found by a group of people who are not doing research. That is where the problem is back home. Because we are just finding solutions, but these solutions are not researched on. And basically, it is trial and error. And most of them, they've been errors. That's where the problem is. So
okay,
to answer your question, I think we need to also grow research in back home in Zambia. That way we can have informed solutions, not just a solution that is thought about by two people, three people, one person. That doesn't work that way.
Okay, excellent. You are a very strong and passionate political analyst, and a lot of people seem to think that you you overdo it or you overreact and all those things.
I'm a cadre.
you are a cadre to yourself, I think so. I'll let the others come in and ask their questions, first of all, before I go to that. Pianki, I don't know whether you had any comment or you wanted to ask Dr. Kalonde anything.
Well, I agree with the last point he made on the research. Zambia should, and every nation should have, African nations should have more research going on in their country, providing for their solutions for the problems that they have. And those problems that they have are similar to what's going on a world scene. They would not only be contributing to their country, but they also would be contributing to the problems of the world. But is the education, a higher education, but we can't forget that you need to have skilled labor, mechanical labor, especially if you're developing nature. You need people in the skilled trades, from welding to cement finishing, sheet metal work, and so on and so on and so on. Because when I was coming up, Nathan, I was exempt from the draft because I was I had an occupational deferment here in the United States. What I ended up doing, there was a shortage of, so I was exempt from the draft. And those things that you have to do, you have to start targeting young people into certain areas, go through a process of seeing how they will perform in this area. And those who show potential, you know, support them to the umpteenth degree to produce your engineers, your scientists, your your physicists and so on and so on and so on. That has to be a major concern too.
Excellent.
I think you are 100% right. Actually, technology. I teach ICT. I teach education technology, and I teach technology education. Technology education is exactly what Mr. Pianchi has mentioned, and that is part of what we call, or we used to call, industrial technology. I teach those things. How to do MasterCam, AutoCAD, manufacturing, and all such things. Now, in Zambia, we call it technical education. The unfortunate part is that since the coming of MMD and the introduction of these private universities, private colleges, exactly what Mr. Pianchi has mentioned is what is missing in our society today. We used to have those mostly sponsored, most on the copper belt, by the mines. But nowadays, those things have disappeared. We need really to send our young men and women into those areas to help with the manufacturing, because it is through those courses that students really understand what is taking place in the industry and in manufacturing and what they can do. A lot of people today in America, they worked in the, like Bianca said, they work in the oil rigs, and most of the students, that part of my group that graduate from here, they go work there as welders. Some of them go and work there as designers. Some of them go and work there just as planners and all such things. So if we in Zambia could think about those things, bring them back and grow them and give them respect as courses that could help grow our economy, I think that would be very, very helpful. But at the moment, we have been oversold with white-collar jobs. That's where the issue is. As a society, we've been oversold with white-collar jobs and thinking working in the bank is the thing that I should do. Working in as a teacher, working as, I don't say that being teaching is the wrong thing, it's right. We want those jobs that do not involve our hands very, very much. That's where the mistake is in our society today. And if you look, it's just now that young men and women are thinking of agriculture, because at one point we never thought about agriculture. So, going by Pianchi's statement, if people are trained in those areas, that will also help in terms of agriculture, because those trade jobs, they also learn how to fix equipment, they learn how to fix tractors, they learn how to even modify some parts of such kind of equipment. So, unfortunately, we haven't sold our society to such kind of training, more especially that white-collar jobs are the ones that are really reaping from our society. We have left out jobs that really grow the economy because we have misunderstood what we're supposed to be doing.
Excellent. You know what you just did, Dr. Kalonde, also following up on what Pianchi just described. What you have just described about, you are saying young men or youths coming into, into the economy and being able to make contributions to that extent. You just described Diva Chisewe here, Daniel Chisewe, okay? He works for himself. He has said it himself to us many times. He's a what? Because of the skills he has, he runs his own trucking operation and he fixes his own vehicles, which means it puts him in a place where he doesn't, he saves money on a lot of things and he doesn't need to, what do you call it? He doesn't need to engage certain people's services and the way he does things. I'll let him say something himself, but let me go to Dr. Patrick and get his comments, and if he has any questions for you, and then I'll go to Dr. Kasonso and then follow with others. Dr. Patrick. Dr. Patrick, are you there? Okay. Let's go to Dubai and see if we can get Dr. Kasonso to do something here. I hope I haven't lost everybody. Am I there, Dr. Kasonso, Dr. Galonde?
Yes, I'm here.
Hello. I was on mute. I can wait, or can I contribute my comments now?
Yes. Please go ahead.
I have two things for my brother, Dr. Kulande, to think about. The first thing has to do with research. There are two types of research. There's research in my field of expertise, which is called applied chemistry research. It's regulatory. What we do is we apply research to make a method better in order to determine the levels of a particular chemical or political mycotoxin in a product, so we can determine the levels. And then there is pure research, and that's usually found in the universities and chemical companies. With respect to the regulatory, applied chemistry, it's usually money in, which is 10%, and money out, which is 90%. That's short-term and long-term. So you can make a lot of money by developing methods for individuals who want to sell their products on the market and want to successfully sell their products on the market. You want to find out if it can pass the standards that are set out. In universities, it's usually money in and 90% and money out 10%, which is short term. It's very rare that people want to put a lot of money into a particular research project in order to get a long-term benefit. The long-term benefit, you get 90% out of it, but it's a lot of money going into it. So that's my first thing for a response in thinking about those type of researches and the type of money you can make out of it. The second thing is, doctor, have you considered or thought about a sister educational exchange partnership, your university partnering with the university in Zambia for a student exchange, as well as many other things?
Actually, just to go back to my history, I thank you very much, Dr. Patrick, for that question. I came on a exchange program, but this was sponsored by the Lusaka, meaning, let me start from where it is. It was sponsored by the Los Angeles Lusaka Sister City Committee. They are the ones who sponsored that. And so it is something that is in my mind. But unfortunately, I'm very new at this university. I'm 2 years here now, going in my third year. What has happened is, we are trying to work with the Copperbelt University, and unfortunately, to say the truth, is that I wrote a letter some time back to Hunza, and that has been almost now 2 years, and I haven't received a response. I spoke to someone at the CBU about the same, and this person has decided that he's going to take it up. He's one of the professors that I was with when I was here in school. He teaches at CBU. So he's working with me on that. but we haven't yet formalized because we haven't had concrete responses, more especially when we send our students from here to go that side. That's where the problem is. Bringing students from there to come here, we can take care of them. But when we send ours that side, that's where the issue is still pending. So we are thinking about that, and I pray and hope that things can work out as soon as possible.
Outstanding, outstanding. Thank you.
Okay, excellent.
You're welcome.
Excellent. Dr. Kasonso, can you, are you there? My any comment or question for Dr. Kalonde? Okay. Kelvin, I need
Nathan,
your help.
Nathan, could we be so kind as to impose on the doctor that we could get regular updates on how he's moving with respect to the sister project? Say maybe every 6 months he can come back to us and let us know how that's progressing and what needs to be done or how we can help to move it along.
I think we can do that. We can do that. Because one of the things I want us to start doing here is to sort of make up follow-up conversations or get updates and look at when we have a conversation like we've had with Dr. Kalonde, with Musaba, and everybody else, we make a follow-up conversation to see where we are and where things stand and how we can proceed or move from there.
Great.
Dr.
Kalonde,
Yeah. I think we need to start doing that and making those types of things rather than just us having things ending up just us talking and Kelvin, check your phone. I sent you a message. I need help behind the scenes. I'm having a situation here with my laptop. Dr. Kalonde, you teach technology and curriculum education. You corrected me in our conversation that there's a difference between technology and information tech or IT, whatever the issue is. Share with us what your job entails and what it involves.
Yeah, like I mentioned that I teach education technology. I teach technology education and I teach ICT. Then I also teach media technology. Most of the time when people hear technology, they always rush to information technology. They are leaving out that there is industrial technology. There is a small segment of ICT in my teaching, and
okay.
Is media technology. Yes. I don't go into program writing. Those are computer engineering programs. So in my case, we can codify, change some codes, and write codes for robots to function or to, to operate. We can write G code, D code, a lot of codes that my students can do to make equipment work. Let's say, for instance, if we have to use the plasma cam. When we use plasma, PlasmaCam, we go into G code or C code or D code, and the students have to. It's computerized. It's computer coding.
Now you are confusing us.
Yeah, it is something that is mostly in industry. When you look at the design of a vehicle, and the cutting of the parts of those parts for the vehicle, those are not done in the by drawing or somebody writing it down. It's done by a computer, and you do the coding for it to do whatever you want to do. So you have a lot of different programs to use, and the MasterCam is one of the programs that is used heavily, but it's very expensive to have. I don't know if we even have people using MasterCam in Zambia because it's very, very expensive actually. Then we have right now programs like Fusion. Fusion is an AutoCAD program that is now doing what Mastercam does. So that helps us to design things and draw them. Like, say, for instance, you want to make something in your 3D printer.
Uh-huh.
3D printing has changed from where it was to something else today. Most of the auto companies, they are using 3D printing for the parts of the vehicles. So now the writing of that program, for you to do the coding for the part to come exactly the way you want it to be, that is where my students come in. They have to design a program. They have to write the coding. It's quite lucrative right now. Coding is quite lucrative. So that's what I teach. And then, we have GIS. The designing and writing of those GIS programs is done by people who come through my programs, like in AutoCAD and in Fusion and other coded programs. That's what we are using. It's quite vasty in terms of what programs you can use. You have to really be savvy in terms of using programs that you want to use for. So what I do is I use programs that are found on the market easily for the students to learn. But those programs help them to go and use any program in the job market.
Okay.
That's what we do. Yeah.
Excellent. Those are the things.
So
that
I'm not
going. Like,
I don't write the programs like they do in the Silicon Valley.
Oh, okay.
We can read them. We can change. I can change what somebody wrote. In a game, say for instance, I teach gaming also, how to write games, how to write games and how to play games and change. I can look at your game and go into the program and change some few things in your game, and then the game will be doing something else. That's what I also teach my students.
Excellent. I think like Dr. Patrick said, the exchange programs, that's where those things like what you've described become very important for us to introducing our higher education system in Zambia. I don't know that Dr. Kasonso's line is open now. I'm sorry, on my end, things are frozen. Dr. Kasonso, are you there?
Nathan.
Yes.
Nathan, something came to mind as the good doctor was speaking, is when we get together for our anniversary of Zambia Blog Talk Radio, and you know we always reach out to the youth and students. What about making a special effort to reach out to students so that the doctor can give a class and inspire and ignite them to be thinking about going into the field in which he just spoke?
Yes, Yang.
You should also, and I should tell Roger this, and I should tell James this, you should have your young people sitting with you when you have discussions like these. Any discussion, whether it's political or any along any line, because the decisions you're making today are the ones they have to live with in the future. And they should be taking part in at least knowing what they can expect.
That's very true. There's one thing that I wanted to discuss when we were talking about education in Zambia and also how it is attached to the economy. And if you know that, if you look very closely, the way things are taking place in our societies back home, and due to the major structural imbalances in terms of the economy, we have an estimated population of about 60% of our population now lives in the urban areas, which is along the line of rail and on the copper belt. And currently we see that Lusaka at the moment has swallowed almost the whole eastern province. People have moved to Lusaka province. And we look at the urban migration continues, but there is no possibility that either the modern sector or the economy of the urban informal sector, which is, in my view, mm-hmm. approaching saturation point can productively absorb more than a small proportion of the current labor force or the annual output of secondary and the tertiary school leavers. So we are having a problem that Roger has brought up most of the time. We're having people leaving high schools, people leaving colleges, and all of them being pushed into... They are not being pushed physically. They are not being pushed by... It's some kind of osmosis because of the way the economy has been somehow drawn in Zambia, whereby... Uh-huh. So people finish high school, people finish college, they are all moving to Lusaka or the Copper Belt. But the rural area, which is supposed to be the most productive of our society, is being left bare with old people. I know that the people have a right to choose where they want to live. But at a certain point, we are having a problem in having young men and women in the cities and leaving the most productive areas with old people running the rural economy, and it's not working out. There should be an area where we're supposed to introduce these things in schools whereby we incentivize being in the rural area and having a small farm in the rural area to grow crops or do some agriculture. If we had to put some incentive in such areas, that would make a big difference in terms of how much people migrate to the urban areas where they are becoming unproductive and just roaming the streets.
Yeah, that's the key, incentive. Our time is up, and I would like you to just comment under 1 minute. The Zambian diaspora community has grown, as you have said yourself. You came to this part of the world in the early 90s, and of course we were not as many as when you came here. The population of Zambians abroad was not as many as we are today. What is our role concerning our country, Dr. Kalonde, as we finish off?
Our role to help or somehow play in the Zambian environment is that we're supposed to be supportive of our society back home, and at the same time, we should take back sometimes our expertise to help grow our economy back home. We cannot just be, like Kelvin has said sometimes, armchair critics. Yes, we can see things differently. We have seen the world, two worlds, the Zambian world and whatever world we are living in the diaspora. So if you have moved from Zambia and you haven't learned something from where you are, then you haven't moved from Zambia. So take what you have learned from wherever you are, take it back home. Let people see what you have learned and how that thing you have learned can contribute to the growth of our country.
Excellent.
That is the only way you can grow your economy, you can grow your society, is by learning some few things and sharing back home. If you don't share, you're just enjoying by yourself, then you haven't learned anything yet.
Yeah. Dr. Kalonde, I have to cut you here. Thank you so much. That was our conversation with one of the Zambian diaspora and sun heroes, like we said. Dr. Gilbert Kalonde is a technology and curriculum education assistant professor at Montana State. He also serves on the board of American Civil Liberties Union in Montana. And we have enjoyed this conversation. Coming up is Open Forum, everybody. Let's go back in.